She won't have you, Neil said before she could answer. Both Slag and Juliana glared at him. Neil was pleased to see the leer on Slag's face had been wiped away. So you won't have me, Slag said, the look in his eyes murderous, but his voice deceptively calm. I wouldn't have put it that way. Juliana stood, sensing, as they all did, that a storm was about to break. You see, while I am indeed honored by your, proposal, I fear we are too different to make a successful match.
Enough!
Slag roared. He thumped his stick on the floor. You should have left it, Neil said, moving to block Juliana from Slag's wrath. But even as he moved in front of her, the door behind them burst open, and four of the largest men Neil had ever seen lumbered inside. Two of them even made Ewan look puny, and that was no easy feat. Julia gawked at them, and Neil thought he might be gawking too before he recovered himself.
Wait,
he said, even as Ewan moved into a defensive stance.
I am certain we can come to some sort of arrangement.
Slag stared at him.
I have a proposal of my own.
Go ahead.
You tell these men to go back to whatever hole they crawled out of and give us Billy.
And in return?
We won't completely destroy you.
Slag stared at him for a long moment. Even Juliana turned to stare at him, her face clearly betraying her thoughts. He was completely and utterly mad. And then Slag began to laugh, and Ewan had a moment when he thought, bloody hell, it might all work out after all. He laughed too, and even Ewan curved one corner of his mouth upward. But then Slag, still smiling, slashed his walking stick through the air and said,
Kill them all!
17.
Julia hadn't intended to scream. She liked to think she would not have screamed if she hadn't been tossed onto the couch and told to get down and stay there. That was an order Julia had no trouble following. She had seen and done a great deal in the time she had dedicated herself to the orphanage. More than 90% of what she had seen and done were not the sort of things ladies should ever see or do. She had broken up fights, cleaned up vomit, nursed sick children, buried the carcasses of dead animals who had chosen the orphanage's stoop as their final resting place. She had endured hunger, cold, lack of sleep, and what she had thought of as fear. But now she realized that she had never before known real fear. Real fear struck her when she watched Neil hurtle himself across the room and slam into Slag. The two men fell back against the hearth, Neil narrowly missing being thrown into the flames. She tore her gaze away from Neil at a loud crash behind her. One of the tables had fallen, and it was no wonder, as the four thugs had encircled Mr. Mostyn, hiding him from view. She only knew he was still on his feet and fighting because she caught flashes of his light hair. And then one of the thugs stumbled back and toppled onto a chair, crushing it, and Mostyn slid through the opening, grasped the table in one hand, broke off a leg, and brandished it at the other thugs. One didn't move quickly enough and took a crack to the head. He fell back, crashing into the couch and almost falling on top of her. It was then she decided that perhaps she might be more out of the way if she climbed under the couch. She scooted under the furnishing just as the thug did tumble onto the couch, causing the entire thing to creak in protest. Julia winced and turned to catch a glimpse of Neil again. She caught sight of him and Slag, still near the blazing hearth, just as Slag swung his stick and struck Neil's arm. Neil faltered but didn't go down. He swung with his good arm, and his fist collided with Slag's nose. Blood sprayed, a rain of crimson, and Slag raised his walking stick for another strike. Julia closed her eyes. She couldn't stay under the couch until this was over. If Mr. Mostyn and Neil lost the fight, and that looked very likely, she was doomed. She had to find her own way out. More importantly, she had to save Billy. She could squeeze out from under the couch and... Her thoughts trailed as she caught a whiff of smoke. She risked another look at Neil. His head was still round, not caved in as she had feared, and he continued to wrestle with Slag before the hearth. Neil had one end wrapped around the end of the walking stick, and he and Slag played tug-of-war with it. Behind them, the fire burned inside the grate. And she still smelled smoke. She turned and looked at Mostyn, her eyes widening. She couldn't see much but legs from this angle, but she could see the overturned lamp and the small licks of fire eating at the rug.
"Oh, no,"
she breathed. In this old building, the fire could spread quickly, blazing into an inferno before any of them had a chance to contemplate escape. The patrons in the front room might get out, but anyone upstairs, where Billy was likely hiding, would burn to death. Julia looked at Neil again, still fighting for his life. If the shuffling feet on the other side of the couch were any indication, Mostyn was engaged in the same battle. It was up to her. Julia slithered out from under the couch, covering her head when one of Mostyn's attackers looked like he might trip and fall on her. He fell the other way, and she scrambled to her knees. She crawled to the fallen lamp, reaching out to right it and then snatching her hand back at the intense heat. She bent and attempted to blow out the burgeoning fire, but too much of the lamp's oil had soaked into the carpet, and her efforts made no difference. Her last hope was smothering the flames. Fingers fumbling, she ripped off her cloak and threw it over the fire, then lifted and lowered it yet again. But she had missed her chance, when the flames had burned through the oil but not yet found other fuel. The fire had slid its talons into the rug's fibers and held on. She watched the trail of fire snake along the pattern of the rug and away from her useless cloak. Julia dropped the garment and did the only other thing she could think to do.
"Fire!" she yelled. "Everyone out! Fire!"
The men fighting Mostyn had already taken notice and scrambled to avoid the flames. Julia glanced at Neil in time to see him wrench the walking stick from Slag's hands and swing it at the crime lord's head. Slag blocked the blow with his arm, but even across the room, she imagined she heard the crack and pop as bone splintered. Her gasp was cut off when she was grabbed about the waist and lifted off the floor. Julia kicked and tried to wrench free.
"It's Mostyn," came the voice of the man holding her. "I'll get you out."
She stopped struggling as Mostyn carried her through the open door of the chamber. Slag's men had fled before them, and she could hear their shouts of "Fire!" as they ran into the tap room. Mostyn made to follow them, but Julia fought him again.
"No!"
He could have ignored her. He was strong enough that her struggles didn't impede him, but he paused and set her down. He bent and looked into her face.
"My lady, the warrior will find his own way out."
Julia was suddenly ashamed that she hadn't been thinking of Neil. She'd wanted to go back for Billy.
"It's not him," she said. "I want to find Billy. We have to get him out."
Neil stepped into the doorway beside them. Perspiration ran down his face from the heat of the fire, making the spattering of blood run down his cheeks in macabre rivulets.
"I'll get him out," Neil said,
his voice hoarse from the smoke that was beginning to burn her throat and lungs.
"You go with the Protector."
"No, I'm coming."
Neil bent and took her chin in his cupped hand.
"Not this time, and don't fight me on this."
He gave her a hard kiss that surprised her not simply because it was unexpected, but because of its intensity. Then he looked at Mostyn.
"Get her out and keep her out."
"Yes, sir."
She didn't even have the chance to say goodbye before she was lifted again, this time slung over Mostyn's shoulder and carried through the smoke-filled building. Outside, Mostyn didn't pause and lower her to the ground. He continued walking until they were well away from the burning ox and bull. Then he set her down, not exactly gently, but carefully at least, and turned to look behind him. Julia found her balance and followed his gaze. The building was engulfed in flames. The dark sky was lit with a haze of red and orange. All around them, men and women rushed toward the building. Some carried buckets of water, but most just wanted to watch. In the rookeries of London, few buildings were insured in case of fire. Even if they had been, the fire brigades were unlikely to venture into those parts of town. If a building caught fire, it burned. Attempts might be made to save the nearby buildings, but if those caught on fire, the best one could hope for was a dousing rain. Julia watched the smoke billow up from the burning alehouse in great plumes. Neil was inside. Neil and Billy. Billy was only a child. He had made a poor choice to go to the Ox and Bull, but he did not deserve to die. She would hold herself responsible if Neil died. He hadn't wanted to take responsibility for the orphans and the orphanage, and she had put him in a position that left him no other options. In fact, since she'd met him, he'd done nothing but take care of her and the boys, thinking of her needs before she even thought of them herself. And then, instead of urging him to get out of the burning building, she'd likely sent him to his death. She had made many mistakes in her life, but this was the first she truly wished she could undo.
"Wait here," Mostyn said, his voice low and filled with gravel from the smoke. In fact, even away from the fire, the smell of smoke still rose from her clothing and choked her throat closed. Or perhaps that was fear and guilt. She nodded, pressing her lips together and watching the flames lick at the roof through watery eyes. What else could they do but wait?
"I'll go back for him," her gaze snapped to Mostyn.
"You're going back? You can't!"
"Wait here," he said, and walked away,
his long legs taking him out of sight before she could think of an argument.
"Idiotic man," she muttered. "Who walks into a burning building?"
She would have to spend the rest of her life feeling guilty for the death of three males. She was such a fool. She should have listened to Raxel in the beginning. She should have brought an army of men into the orphanage to keep the boys safe and slag out. She didn't know where she would have found the funds for such an army, but that seemed like a paltry concern at the moment. And now Slag was dead. Neil's blow might not have killed him, but the fire would. Would his cronies come after her? Would they know she had been responsible, indirectly but still responsible, for his demise? Julia took a deep breath and tried to quiet her mind. A group of men ran past, and she pushed herself into the shadows. She knew where the orphanage was from here, but she dared not go alone, especially now that she'd lost her cloak and her copper hair would be a beacon to anyone looking for her. But how long should she wait for Mostyn to return? What if he never returned? What if he returned carrying the lifeless body of Neil?
"Please let him be alive," she prayed.
She had no right to ask God for anything after the sins she'd committed today, sins for which she was not even sorry, for the pleasure Neil had given her seemed a small price to pay for a mark against her name, if indeed St. Peter was keeping track.
"Lord," she whispered, "if you save him, I promise to entertain no more impure thoughts and refrain from any further impure behaviours. Just save him."
She opened her eyes, and a woman with a scarred face and loose but matted brown hair stared at her. Julia inhaled sharply, immediately wishing she hadn't, for the woman smelled truly rank and pressed farther back. But she was up against the building and had no room to hide herself more.
"Was you praying?"
the woman asked, her accent so thick even Julia could hardly understand her.
"I was."
Her voice shook from fear and emotion.
"My friends are in that fire."
"Good." The woman stepped forward. "Then there'll be no one to help you."
She moved closer, so close that she pressed against Julia, who was forced to turn her head to the side to avoid touching her nose to the woman's as well as the stench.
"What do you want?" Julia asked, trying not to breathe too deeply.
"I want ye blunt."
As she spoke, her hands grasped hold of Julia's waist, then skittered like bony beetles up and down her sides.
"Where do ye keep your purse?"
She felt for pockets in the dress and, finding them, delved inside. Julia resented the violation and pushed the woman back.
"Leave me alone. I don't have any coin with me."
"Come now, fine lady like you."
The woman looked her up and down, then shoved one shoulder into her chest and continued patting Julia. Julia tried to catch her breath, even as the woman's hands felt up her arms and over her breasts.
"Remove your hands. I'm no fine lady. I live at Sunnybrook Home for Boys."
The woman leaned her head back.
"Where?"
Julia blew out a breath.
"St. Dismas. The orphanage. I don't have any blunt."
The woman pulled an embroidered handkerchief from Julia's bodice.
Maybe not, but I can sell this for a penny.
Julia shoved her back.
Then sell it and be gone.
But the woman was staring at her hair.
Not so fast. Your hair is a fine colour.
Julia put her hand to her head.
Get away!
The woman produced a dull knife with the dexterity of a professional.
Might fetch me a crown or more.
You cannot have it. Go on before I scream.
The woman laughed, or rather cackled.
Scream all you want, dearie. No one will hear you.
She raised the knife and moved toward Julia. Julia had two choices at that moment. Give up her hair or fight. She'd always been rather proud of her hair. It was vanity, she supposed, and unfounded vanity, as the colour was not fashionable. Still, she knew it suited her, and more men than she could count had complimented it. One had even had the audacity to touch it, but her hair was not worth dying for, and yet, if she didn't fight now, when would she fight? She couldn't hide under couches, metaphorical or otherwise, for the rest of her life. She couldn't close her eyes and hope those who wished to harm her, men like Slag, would simply disappear. If she'd fought Slag from the beginning, maybe Neil wouldn't be in a burning building. Maybe Mostyn wouldn't be risking his life to save him. Maybe she wouldn't be on the street being accosted by a foul-smelling hair thief.
"Leave me be," Julia said, and took a step toward the woman, and, dear God, the knife.
"Stand still, or I'll slit your throat and then take your hair,"
the woman advanced, but Julia didn't cower. She had no room to back away. Instead, she made a grab for the knife. The woman slashed down, and bright pain flared in her arm. But Julia grabbed the woman's wrist anyway, pushing her assailant's arm back. A quick glance showed her the pain in her arm was accompanied by a stream of blood.
"Now look what you done,"
the woman said, struggling to wrench free of Julia's hold.
"What I've done?"
Julia used her momentum to push the woman a step back.
"Who knows what sorts of filth you have on that blade?"
She would probably die of some horrible, as yet undiscovered disease. She forced the woman back another step, but it was a hard-won victory. The woman was tall, and Julia was barely medium height. Both women were breathing hard, and Julia was grateful the struggle had forced the woman to stop speaking. Her muscles burned, and blood ran down her arm, but she refused to give in to fatigue. This was life and death. If she failed, Mostyn would find her lifeless body when and if he returned. Her bald, lifeless body. With a growl, the woman pushed back, and Julia stumbled. Her feet scrambled for purchase, and she regained her balance and fought back. She might be small, but she had spent the last few months carrying small children, laundry and heavy pots. She was strong. The woman bared her teeth and pushed Julia back again, lowering her knife hand a fraction of an inch. Julia tried to raise the knife, but gravity was not on her side. She was tiring. The woman pushed her back again, and this time Julia lost ground, her feet sliding backward. She concentrated all her strength on keeping the knife high and away from her face, but as she watched, the knife came closer and closer. The dull blade, red with her blood and black with God knew what, dipped lower and lower. Julia tried to muster the strength to make one last push, but all she could manage was to keep the knife from plunging into her forehead. Dear God, she would die this day. She had survived the Oxen Bull, survived Slag, and made it out of a raging fire, only to be killed on the street by a hair thief. She closed her eyes as the knife moved closer, infinitesimally nearer to her skin. She did not want this woman's face to be the last thing she saw. And then suddenly, the woman's wrist sprang free of Julia's grip, and the knife clattered to the ground. A dark-skinned man had the woman about the waist and shoved her at a pale man streaked with soot. Julia's gaze flew to the man who'd saved her. It was Neil, his skin covered with soot and ash. Only his sea-blue eyes were recognizable to her. He was alive.
"Mr. Axel," she gasped.
"Good God! But can no one leave you alone for even a moment?" She wanted to tell him if he insisted on being so surly, he could go straight back into the fire, but just then her legs gave way, and she wobbled.
His arms caught her around the waist, even as she caught herself, but he swept her up anyway, bringing her closer to his chest and the overpowering smell of smoke and fire.
"I can walk," she insisted.
"And step into the middle of a dice game or a street brawl. I think I had better carry you for your own good."
"You are acting like an ass," she said,
too tired to care that she'd used language unbecoming a lady.
"Yes, well, watching you almost stabbed through the eye brings out the worst in me."
She looked up at him, hoping to discern something from his face. Was his statement an admission that he cared for her, or was he simply angry that she might die and he be blamed for not meeting his responsibilities? But she could not see his features through the black grime, and then she remembered Mostyn and Billy. She struggled to look behind her.
"Where is Billy? Did you find him?"
"I'm here, my lady," came a voice from somewhere nearby.
Raxel was moving quickly through the dark streets of Spitalfields, but she could not pinpoint the voice, but she knew it.
"Billy?"
She reached out a hand, and the boy took it. His hand was the same size as hers, but rougher. He squeezed it.
"Major found me, he did. Got me out just in time.
Thank God. I will scold you later for all the trouble you caused, but now I am so thankful to have you alive."
"Could we save the speeches for when we're safely indoors?" Raxel muttered. "The less attention we draw to ourselves, the better."
"What about Mr. Mostyn?" she asked, ignoring Neil's injunction. "I thought I saw him..."
"Here, my lady."
He moved from behind Neil so she could see him, and then back again. He truly did seem to always be at Neil's back.
"Thank you," she said to him.
He gave a curt nod and went back to his position. They were all accounted for and safe, or nearly safe, at any rate. Slag was gone. His alehouse was gone. She did not know if Goring had survived or not, but she did not think he would dare show his face again. But most importantly, Billy and the other boys were safe. She hadn't lost one. She could rest now. Leaning her head on Neil's chest, she closed her eyes and dreamed of fire. Neil had felt fear. He had known dread and profound loss, but nothing could compare to the terror he'd felt when he caught sight of Juliana and the street wench struggling with the knife. In that moment, the rank, muddy street in Spitalfields became a battlefield once again, and he was racing against time to save Christopher. He raced to save Juliana, but in his mind they had become one and the same. He hadn't been able to reach Christopher in time, and he would not be able to reach Juliana. He would live the rest of his life with the image of her death imprinted in his brain box, the way he stored the images of the deaths of so many of those who trusted their lives to him. Neil knew if she died, he would not live long. This was one death he could not survive. He'd begun to run, pushing through the crowd still heading for the Ox and Bull and the spectacle of the fire. When he'd reached the wench with the knife, he was certain he'd been too late. He'd pulled her off Juliana, prepared to rip her to shreds with his bare hands when he'd heard Juliana's voice. The woman had been forgotten, and in that moment there was only Juliana. He held her close and stood in the entryway of the orphanage. When they'd come in, just the three of them, as Mostyn had melted away once they'd reached the building. Jackson had bustled the other boys off to their beds, taking Billy by the shoulders and threatening a bath. Rafe had only glared at him, taking in his soot-stained face and clothing.
"I get all the worst missions," he complained before leaving in a huff.
Neil rolled his eyes. The cook's brows lifted, and then she retreated to the kitchen to prepare something soothing, but Mrs. Dunwitty had seemed unperturbed.
"She always was a trial, this one. I told her father on many occasions her life and mine would have been a great deal easier had she been born male."
Neil supposed that would have made his life easier too, but he couldn't wish for it, not when he held her soft body in his arms, loving the way her curves pressed against him.
"Don't just stand there, Mr. Raxel. Carry her to her chamber. I don't suppose there's a maid about," she said as she ascended the stairs in front of him. "I imagine I will have to see to that as well. Ah, Jackson, there you are."
Jackson had been shepherding the boys into their room, but he took a few steps into the corridor.
May I be of service, Mrs. Dunwitty? Yes, you may. I need hot water for a bath and clean linen for a bandage. My lady is filthy and injured.
Jackson glanced at Juliana, who looked relatively clean compared to Neil.
I will have Mrs. Koch heat water and bring it personally.
He gave Neil a direct look.
While the lady is bathing, sir, perhaps you might do the same downstairs.
Neil frowned. He didn't want to leave Juliana, but Mrs. Dunwitty would hardly allow him to stay while she bathed Juliana, even if he'd already seen far more of her than he ought.
Very good, Jackson.
Neil looked at the former governess.
Shall I hold her until the water arrives? If I set her on the bed, the sheets will need washing.
No need, came a small, quiet voice. Juliana moved in his arms.
I am awake. I don't know what came over me.
Shock and exhaustion, I imagine, said her former governess. Let us just hope you have not caught some dreadful disease of the lower orders whilst you were out and about in those dreadful streets.
You know I am never sick, she told the woman, pushing out of Neil's arms.
He was forced to release her, his body protesting at the loss of her warmth and her softness.
And I intend to keep it that way. Now, out of those clothes. Jackson will draw you a bath.
Mrs. Dunwoody gave Neil a pointed look.
Excuse me, he said and moved into the hallway.
There he was confronted by four sets of small eyes, each wider than the last.
What's this? He said. I thought you were all in bed.
Will she die?
Asked Chester, his dark hair rumpled and his cheeks wet.
We can't let her die,
Charlie said, or something to that effect. His thumb was firmly in his mouth.
"She ain't going to die, is she?" said Jimmy.
"No," said Neil. "She will not die."
"I told you,"
James broke in, hands wiping at the wetness on his cheeks.
"I told you Major would keep our lady safe."
Neil put his hands on James's shoulder.
"And so I will. I'll keep all of you safe. And that is a promise."
He did not know how he would keep that promise, but he meant it.
Now, back to bed with you.
Laurie,
Charlie asked.
No story tonight, Neil translated. My lady or I will read you one tomorrow.
The boys groaned.
I'll read them a story.
Neil turned and saw Robbie behind him. He also spotted Juliana leaning on the casement in her doorway. Their eyes met. Hers shiny with unshed tears before she closed her door.
You can read,
Neil asked before glancing back at Robbie. The boy shrugged.
A little. Come on, boys, climb into bed. Uncle Robbie will tuck you in tonight.
The boys cheered and raced into their rooms, all fears for Lady Juliana momentarily put to rest. Robbie made to follow, then looked back at Neil.
And if I can't read the words, I can always make them up, right?
Neil nodded.
A time-honored tradition among storytellers.
That's what I thought. He wrinkled his nose. You'd best clean up, Major. You stink.
Thank you, Robbie.
He moved toward the steps, listening as Robbie said something that made the little boys giggle. For the first time he could remember, Neil felt like he was home.
18.
Julia closed the door and turned to a narrow-eyed Mrs. Dunwitty.
You have ideas.
Julia blinked.
No, I don't, she answered quickly.
Denial of all culpability was second nature when it came to dealing with Mrs. Dunwitty.
Oh, yes, you do. And I know, because if I were a few years younger, I would have the same ideas.
Julia stared at her, hoping she had misunderstood. Mrs. Dunwitty held out a hand.
Give me your clothing. I doubt it is salvageable. Why don't you employ a maid, for goodness sake? And do not stare at me so. I was young once.
I don't have the funds for a maid. Julia pulled off her gloves and the remnants of her hat. She refused to imagine Mrs. Dunwitty as young. Mrs. Dunwitty looked at the proffered articles and motioned for Julia to drop them on the floor.
I had plenty of beaux when I was your age, and in my time we were far less prudish.
Oh, dear, Julia muttered. This was not at all a conversation she wished to be part of. She bent to unlace her boots.
"How did the boys' lessons go today?" she asked.
"But when the time came," Mrs. Dunwoody said, ignoring Julia's attempt to change the subject, "I decided marriage was not for me. I wanted my freedom. I think you of all women understand that."
Julia removed her half boots. They were dirty but still serviceable. Though she moved to the side of her discarded garments, then unpinned her bodice and loosed the tapes of her dress, allowing it to fall to the floor. Once her outer garments were removed, Mrs. Dunwoody stepped forward to assist her with her stays.
"I can manage," she said. "You are tired and have been through quite the ordeal from what I can see. I'll hear no argument."
Julia was tired, and she offered none as her stays were removed, and when the hot water arrived, she wore only her chemise and stockings. She retreated behind a screen to wash. The small hip bath she had bought for the orphanage and insisted the boys use at least once a week was in the older boys' dormitory. She always made do with soap, a cloth, and water from a basin. At least this water was hot.
"It's obvious you feel something for Mr. Wraxall," Mrs. Dunwoody said on the other side of the screen.
Julia heard her moving about, probably straightening up Julia's already straight chambers.
"In your absence, I asked his man, Jackson, about his presence here. Apparently Mr. Wraxall has been living here for several days, unchaperoned."
Julia paused in the act of sliding the cloth over her face.
"I am hardly in need of a chaperone at this point," she said. "I have been living, more or less, in a house with 12 boys for a quarter of a year." "Those are boys. Mr. Wraxall is a man."
"He is a gentleman my father sent to take me home. That is all." She rubbed the cloth over her knife wound. It was a scratch, really, but it still burned. Mrs. Dunwoody huffed.
"Your father might have sent Wraxall, but if he knew the man had taken up residence—"
"Mr. Wraxall has not taken up residence. He will be leaving in a day or so. And now that you are here, we are adequately chaperoned. Not that anyone will care. Like you, Mrs. Dunwoody, I have chosen not to marry. In time, my father will come to accept that. He will understand that this is the life I want, and I am quite content to live here and help these boys."
"Oh, is that why you came here? To help these boys? I thought it was because you were running away."
"I have never run away from anything in my life."
"You ran away from the situation with Lanesborough."
Julia dropped the cloth and stuck her head around the screen.
"I did not run away. I did everything I could to keep Davy. I fought Lanesborough until the end."
Mrs. Dunwoody's eyes held sorrow, but Julia did not want her sorrow. Instead, she focused on the older woman's mouth, which was set in a determined line. Julia wanted determination.
"And I lost. The court and the judge, and even the bloody regent. Language, Julia. Did not care about the best interests of the child, or what his mother would have wanted, or that his father didn't even show the most remote interest in the child until he was half a year old. The law gives the man precedence in this case, as in practically every case. Now, you tell me why I should want to tie myself to a man when men are selfish, manipulative, and cruel at best."
"Your father was not cruel."
"My father was benignly neglectful, and when I needed him, when Harriet needed him, he would not lift a finger,"
Julia cried, her voice rising to a pitch that heralded tears.
"Now I am in a position to help, and I will not walk away. Mrs. Dunwoody, if you have come hoping to persuade me to return home or to abandon these children, then you should know that I will do neither."
Mrs. Dunwoody nodded and said nothing. After a moment, Julia moved back behind the screen. She took a moment to compose herself, then finished washing. When she'd dressed in a clean chemise and come around the screen, Mrs. Dunwoody waited with Julia's robe and some linen she'd torn into bandages.
"And yet," she said quietly after she'd bandaged Julia's arm and held out the robe, "you are in love with Wraxall."
Julia started.
"I most certainly—" Mrs. Dunwoody raised her hand. "Do not bother to deny it. I saw him with those children just now. I fell half in love with him, and it was still in your eyes when you closed the door."
"I can't love him. I've only known him a handful of days.
"And you think there are rules to falling in love?" Mrs. Dunwoody laughed. "Even if there were, you would not follow them. But you must hear me in this, Juliana."
At the serious note in her voice, Julia looked up.
"You must not go to bed with him."
Julia thought she would tip over from mortification. This was worse than when her mother had tried to explain where babies come from.
"Please stop," she begged. "Let me say my piece. Must you?"
"It is clear to me you want him in your bed, and I have no doubt he wants to be there. But if you sleep with him, it will be that much harder to let him go. The children have already become attached to him. Do not allow yourself to become any more attached, or you will not be able to support them in their grief because you will be mired in your own."
Mrs. Dunwoody was correct, of course. She knew this. It had never been her plan to become attached to Neil, nor to allow the boys to become attached to him. And yet somehow he had found a way into all of their hearts. But she was not so young and innocent as to delude herself into believing he would stay simply because she wished he would. She was not so foolish as to ask him to stay because even if he desired to stay, she had no room in her life for a man. She might fancy herself in love with him, but that did not mean she trusted him or that she could count on him. He had proven himself to be trustworthy and dependable thus far, but in the end he would fail her. Every other man in her life had.
"The boys are my sole concern," Julia said. "He has been a good influence on them, but we must all prepare ourselves for his departure. Now that we are safe from some of the more dangerous occupants of Spitalfields, I believe Mr. Raxall intends to see to the roof repairs and be gone."
"Good. In my opinion, the sooner the better. The last thing you should ever do is allow him too many liberties or an entree into your bed."
Julia's cheeks flamed. Dear God, she would say her prayers faithfully for a year if Mrs. Dunwoody would only speak of something else, anything else.
"I see you are tired, so I will leave you to rest. We shall discuss the boys' lessons in the morning. Their arithmetic is not bad, but their reading is very poor indeed. Shockingly poor."
And with that, the woman left Julia in peace. Neil hadn't intended to be standing in the corridor outside Juliana's chamber when Mrs. Dunwoody emerged. He quickly tried to look as though he had some purpose for being there, ostensibly to check on the little boys, but he feared he failed miserably when Mrs. Dunwoody stopped and gave him a pointed look.
"Mr. Raxall, do not think I do not know what you are doing here."
"I wanted to make certain the boys..." She dismissed his excuse with a wave.
"I have spoken with my former charge and warned her against your charms."
Neil raised a brow.
"My charms?"
"Yes. More to the point, I told her specifically not to allow you into her bed. Knowing that girl, the more I tell her not to do something, the more likely she is to do it. And so I will warn you as well to stay away from Lady Juliana. Go back to your rooms and go to sleep."
"Yes, Mrs. Dunwoody."
"Good night, then."
And she started for her own rooms at a clipped pace. Neil was accustomed to following orders, and he almost turned to follow the lady, as they both had chambers in the servants' quarters. But then he paused to wonder why Juliana's former governess would tell her charge not to allow him into her bed if that would only make her more likely to do so. And if she made such a blunder, why would she make her mistake known to him? Did the lady want him to seduce Juliana? Rather, further seduce Juliana? Was she playing matchmaker? If so, this was a rather unorthodox method, since, for all she knew, he might get Juliana with child and then leave her to suffer the consequences. But if she thought him capable of such behaviour, she would have undoubtedly thrown him out on his ear already. He had no doubt she was capable of that, and much more. Which still left him standing in the corridor, wondering what he was about. He didn't need to check on the little boys. Robbie had seen to that. Their room was dark and quiet, as was the older boy's dormitory. The boys, even Billy, slept in clean beds under warm blankets. Their bellies were full, or reasonably so, considering young boys were never really full, and they were safe from the likes of Slag and his men. Neil hadn't considered how truly remarkable this orphanage was. He had not spent much time in any orphanage, but even he knew that they were little more than dens of disease and misery. If what he had seen of orphans on the streets of London was any indication, the children were unwashed, practically starving, and dressed in rags. Of course, there were a few orphans who were left at institutions accompanied by funds to be used for the rearing of the child, but as there was virtually no oversight, those who ran the orphanages were free to use the funds for whatever they liked, which was, more often than not, lining their own pockets. But here was a place that had been likely as miserable and wretched as any other orphanage in London, and Lady Juliana had come in and made it a haven. She had few funds from the board of directors, and so all the improvements she had done she must have paid for herself. The children were clean, fed, and looked after. Now that Slag was dead, Billy and Walter were safe from being coerced into joining his gang, and Juliana was in part responsible for Slag's demise, too. Neil had walked into the orphanage and seen all the potential dangers for the daughter of an earl. Thus, he had failed to see all the ways she had provided security for these children, who would have been out on the streets of London had she not stepped in. No wonder she had resisted his help initially. She did not want one more outsider trying to save her when the real danger was what would happen to the children if she returned to Mayfair. And he still had not answered his own question as to what he was doing pacing outside her bedchamber. For all intents and purposes, his work here was done. St. Maur could hire men to repair the roof. It wasn't as though Neil knew anything about roof repair. He would have hired men himself. Of course, he'd planned to supervise the work and keep an eye on Juliana at the same time, but now that Slag was no longer a threat, she didn't really need him. He could try and persuade her to go home to her father, but that was a losing battle. Neil didn't make a habit of fighting battles he could not win. She probably wouldn't care if he told her she still wasn't safe. New threats could come at any time, but he couldn't live here permanently, just in case she needed protection again. Could he? Of course not. He had his own life. He was busy mourning his fallen friends, drinking himself into a stupor and fighting off nightmares. Not to mention, once every 2 or 3 months his father had some small task for him to complete. If Neil stayed at the orphanage, he would give up all those hours sitting alone in his rooms or whiling away the hours at the Draven Club, nursing the what-ifs and flagellating himself for putting Draven's men into deadly situations, which was, of course, the very idea of a suicide troop. Neil stopped pacing and stood in front of Juliana's door. If he went inside, if he stayed, he would have to marry her. He couldn't marry her. What kind of husband would he be? He was a bastard, and she the daughter of an earl. The door to Juliana's room opened, and she jumped back when she spotted him. "Raxel!" "I didn't mean to startle you, my lady," he said. "Then what do you mean by standing outside my door?"
"I..."
He had no answer, but he knew a few interrogation techniques.
"Why did you open it?"
"I... because I wanted to check on the boys." It was a lie, if he'd ever heard one, but he'd be damned if he would call her on it. His gaze had dipped from her face to the V of her robe, which was open slightly to reveal the lacy white night rail. With her coppery hair down about her shoulders and her cheeks pink from being freshly scrubbed, she looked very much like a dollop of cream with a cherry on top, and Neil would have liked to lick his way down the cream-covered expanse of her body.
"Tell me," he said, his voice gravelly, "why does the matron of an orphanage for boys wear a night rail with such a revealing bodice?"
He reached out and trailed one finger along the opening of the robe, parting it farther to reveal more of the swell of her breasts. He had been prepared to be slapped away, but she all but leaned into his touch. She had been lying when she'd claimed she'd opened the door to check on the boys. He would have wagered a sovereign that she had planned to go to him. And though he had no skill at gaming, Neil was certain he would have won this wager.
"It's not mine," she said, her voice little more than a whisper. "You stole it." More and more intriguing.
"I didn't. No, I..." She looked up and down the corridor. "Should we have this conversation elsewhere? I'm afraid we might wake the boys."
Neil thought a horse race was unlikely to wake the boys after a day of lessons with Mrs. Dunwitty, but he didn't argue. Instead, he took a step forward and then another.
Juliana took a step back, and Neil followed her into her chamber, closing the door behind him and locking it. Her brown eyes darted to the closed door.
"This is most inappropriate."
"As is that garment." He wanted to move closer, to push the robe off her shoulders and see what tantalized beneath it more clearly, but he stood rooted in place.
"It was meant for a bride."
Neil lifted a brow. "Were you betrothed?"
"My sister was. She married Viscount Lanesborough. This," she gestured to the nightgown and robe, "was part of her trousseau, but the valise into which it was packed was left behind. When my lady's maid packed for what was to be a brief stay at Sunnybrook, she must have thought I'd already packed this valise and sent it with the rest of my things."
Neil did step forward. "It suits you."
"It seems silly to wear it here, surrounded by squalor and shabbiness, but I suppose I like to forget where I am at times and pretend I am still the spoiled, naive Earl's daughter."
"I can't picture you as spoiled, though you've held on to a great deal of that naivety." She narrowed her eyes.
"Always quick with the compliments, I see. You should have known me before."
"You wouldn't have spoken to me before."
"You wouldn't have spoken to me. I was unbearably stupid and frivolous."
He stood before her and reached one hand to caress the sleeve of her robe. "What changed you?"
"Davy," she said.
Neil stiffened. He hadn't been prepared for the possibility of another man, but now that he considered it, why hadn't he supposed that she would be in love with and loved by someone? She was smart, brave, and beautiful. What man wouldn't want her? But if she loved another, then why had she allowed him to touch her so intimately earlier that day? Why did she allow his hand on her arm now? Neil dropped his hand.
"And who is Davy?"
She shook her head.
"I don't think I should talk about this."
"It's too late for that."
She shook her head, making her hair flutter about her shoulders.
"You don't want to hear my sad tale?"
"Why not? You heard mine."
He met her gaze directly.
"Why not show me what you're hiding?"
"I'm not hiding."
"But you are."
He ran his hand along the sleeve of her robe again, but refrained from divesting her of it. Now there was Davy between them.
"Davy, David, is my nephew, and certainly no secret."
"Your sister's son?"
She looked down.
"Yes, and her only child. She died just hours after he was born."
"I'm sorry to hear that."
And he was. As a man who had never known his own mother, he could empathize with this child who would also grow up motherless. However, this child had been born within the realm of matrimony, which meant he would be accepted and wanted. He would have the love of his father and obviously that of his aunt, unless something had happened to the child.
"Where is Davy now?" he asked.
"With his father."
Neil nodded.
"As to be expected, I suppose."
Her eyes flashed fire, and she rounded on him.
"Why, pray tell, is that to be expected? Why should a child be reared by his father as a default? Not every father is a suitable guardian."
He had stepped, unwittingly, into a battle zone. He could either make a hasty retreat or fight his way through. He wasn't certain what he was fighting for, but Neil had fought many battles where victory was undefined. Sometimes that was the nature of conflict.
"You have a point," he conceded. "Am I to understand Davy's father was less than desirable?"
"He is much worse than less than desirable. He didn't care a fig for the child until he realized that I wanted him. You see, I opposed his marriage to Harriet, and so he has always hated me. He took Davy away simply to spite me, and now..."
Tears glittered in her eyes.
"I've lost him forever."
And with those words, Neil finally understood. 19. He stood looking at her as though she were daft. Julia could hardly blame him. Perhaps she was daft. Here she was, months after Davy had been taken away, crying over him as though he'd just been torn from her arms yesterday. But there were moments, many moments, when the wound still felt that raw and tender. She half expected Neil to make an excuse and get away, but he didn't look as though he was going anywhere. He stood before her, not touching her any longer, but remaining close, offering her the comfort of his arms if she would only step into them. And perhaps she should. She had already said far more than she'd wanted. What was one more mistake?
"And this Lanesborough won't allow you to be part of the child's life."
She looked away, fighting the tears, threatening to spill.
"As I said, he hates me."
Neil raised his brows.
"I fail to see how anyone could hate you."
She gave a short laugh, glancing at him to see if he was serious. "I think you know quite well that I have the capacity to be, shall we say, stubborn."
"You?"
He shook his head.
"Never."
She was smiling, the tears held at bay. "Your charms will not sway me, Mr. Axel."
"I have charms,"
he pretended innocence. "We shall return to the matter of my charms later. Now, I want to hear the story of this man who is such a bad judge of character." She felt weary, and no wonder, as she'd destroyed a crime lord and fought off a knife-wielding assailant, and that had been just this afternoon. Julia sat on the bed.
"Yes, well, the Viscount thought I was a bad judge of character."
"His character?" Neil sat beside her, which she knew was improper, as was his presence in her bedchamber, but she couldn't seem to manage to protest.
"He was all show and no substance. I knew it the first time I met him. He is like an actor on a stage who plays a part with such depth and emotion it brings tears to your eyes, but off stage he is shallow and vain and cares more for the cut of his coat than the thousands of orphans roaming the streets."
"In all fairness, most of London cares more for the cut of a coat than the plight of orphans." She waved a hand.
"Yes, but you know what I mean. He played a part with my sister."
"And she believed it."
"And you did not.
Did she also care for orphans?"
"Not really. She was a member of several benevolent societies, but all ladies are." It shamed her to say this, but as long as she was spilling her soul, "I didn't always care as much about orphans as I do now."
"Well, this is shocking." She rolled her eyes, but she could appreciate how he used levity. She was trying quite diligently not to appreciate the feel of his body beside hers. When he'd sat on the bed beside her, the mattress had given, and his thigh rested against hers. She liked the solid heat of him there, too much. Images of earlier that day came to her, of his mouth on her breast and between her legs. She wanted that again, and she knew she should never have allowed it the first time. She should not even be thinking of it now.
"I always wanted to do something, to help as much as I could, which is why I became involved with St. Dismas. I even visited several times, but I was only too happy to allow myself to be convinced that all was as it should be, even though the children were dirty and too thin. I had balls to attend and the theatre to dress for."
She was quiet, remembering that life, when she'd been carefree and ignorant, when she and Harriet spent hours primping before mirrors and gossiping about the most eligible men in the ton.
"And then Harriet met Lanesborough," Julia whispered, "and everything changed. I tried to like him, if only because she liked him so much, but I could not, and I loved my sister and voiced my concerns to her. Of course, she told him, and though he pretended to play the gallant knight who would win me over, I could see he hated me for daring to jeopardize his chance with St. Maur's eldest daughter. We both had substantial dowries. Well, I still have mine. Lanesborough wanted Harriet's, and after they married, it became clear why."
"Gambling debts," Neil said.
"You know him?"
But one look at his face told Julia he didn't. She supposed it was not difficult to guess why a man of the upper classes might need blunt.
"You know men like him," she said. "Yes, he gambled too much and drank too much and, well, did everything too much. The day after he married my sister, he disappeared for 3 nights. We later heard he had spent the time at—" Her cheeks blushed. "A house of ill repute," she whispered.
Neil didn't comment, for which Julia was thankful. Nothing he might have said at that moment would have comforted her. Instead, he simply took her hand and held it. She surprised herself by squeezing his hand tightly. She closed her eyes to finish the story.
After that, he was more often away than home. When my sister discovered she was with child, she came home to be with me.
Our father did what he could to keep Lanesborough away, but the Viscount had little interest in her at any rate. He'd wanted her money, and he had it. Harriet's confinement had been a mixed blessing. She had grown more beautiful with each passing week as her body ripened with child. The sisters had spent all their time together, something social responsibilities had made all but impossible the past few years. Despite her father's protests, Julia had withdrawn from society to be with her sister, who also shunned society and the news she would hear of her husband's infidelities.
When her time came, there was no reason to think it should be anything out of the ordinary. She could not look at him as she spoke these words. She shouldn't have been in the room when the baby was delivered, much less speak about it to a man. But who else could she tell? And it seemed now that the dam was open. She could not stop it up again. The delivery seemed normal to me. Difficult, yes, but when we were younger and my mother was still alive, she would tell us about her painful labours to make Harriet and I feel guilty for vexing her. Neil laughed quietly, and Julia smiled too. But then after the baby came, Harriet seemed to become worse, not better. She was too exhausted to hold her son, and she was so pale. Julia swallowed. And there was so much blood. I took Davy to meet his grandfather, but when I returned, I became alarmed at what I saw. Harriet could not be revived. The midwife was in tears, and when we called for the doctor, he said there was nothing he could do. She was dead before the end of the day.
Neil's hand tightened where it held hers.
I laid Davy in her arms, but the baby cried when he was away from me. Still, we stayed until the end, and then, when she was gone, I made the mistake of falling in love with Davy, though he'd never been mine to love.
What did Lanesborough do when he was informed he had a son and heir? Julia swiped at her eyes.
Nothing. He did not answer our letters or come to see the child. I think I began to believe Davy might be mine. I can't tell you how I wished he'd been born a girl. If he'd been born a girl, Lanesborough wouldn't have ever taken notice of her, no matter how much he wanted to spite me. Girls were not worth his attention. But I suppose because the child was his heir, eventually he had to take an interest. One day he came to the house and demanded to see Davy. The baby was almost 6 months old at that time, and just so beautiful. Lanesborough didn't speak to him or even touch him, but he saw how attached I was to the child and how much the little boy loved me. Maybe if he hadn't seen that...
Neil lifted her hand to his lips and kissed it.
Shh! None of that now. No what-ifs.
She nodded. She knew the particular hell she entered when she gave in to that line of thinking.
He came back the next week with his attorney and his footman and took the child away. I tried to protest, screaming and crying, but I had no argument. Legally, the child is his. I managed to be calm and feign happiness when I had to hand Davy over. He was scared enough as it was, and I didn't want to add to that. The tears fell unbidden. But I will never forget the way he held out his chubby hands to me, or the way he cried as though his world was ending, or the fear in his eyes. I will never forgive myself for abandoning him.
You didn't abandon him. He was taken away. Those are two very different situations.
And yet I still feel as though I failed him, as though I continue to fail him. Where is he now? Who comforts him when he wakes crying? Who holds him and hugs him?
She sniffed and closed her eyes to stem the flow of tears before they threatened to overwhelm her. When she opened her eyes again, Neil had a determined expression on his face.
It wouldn't be difficult to discover the answer to those questions.
Julia wanted to hug him. Sweet, sweet man.
I already know the answers. Davy has a nurse, and Lanesborough has a house full of servants. Though he may rarely be home, the child is cared for.
Neil's expression turned perplexed.
Then why are you crying?
Because it's not me holding him. It's not me.